Okay, well, here's a question for today. Do you think God has got a sense of humour? Now, it's one thing to say that human beings have a sense of humour, but God? I mean, why would he? The World Economic Forum meets in Davos this week, and it's been on the news, and you'd think from the coverage of that forum, they'd be a fairly humourless bunch of people. But their website has an article that got me thinking. It tells us that as far as human beings are concerned, studies have shown that a sense of humour can improve your mental and physical health, boost your attractiveness, and improve your leadership skills. And there are three basic sorts of things that people think are funny. Relief theory argues that laughter and humour are ways of blowing off psychological steam, a way to release tension. That's why jokes at funerals are often met not with a sour face, but uproarious laughter instead. Superiority theory was originally formulated by Plato and Aristotle way back in Greek times to explain a specific kind of humour, why we laugh at others' misfortunes. In that theory, humour is a means of declaring your superiority over other people by laughing at them, you see. But then there's incongruity theory. And that argues that humour arises when two contrasting, distinct ideas are mingled. So, humour often subverts expectations, and punchlines are often the result of an unexpected reversal. And it's that last one that we've got going on here in Esther chapter 6. Has God got sense of humour? Humans seem to need humour. But does God? For people, it guards against depression, improves people's quality of life. It's like a psychological immune system. But it's not just a cheering effect that humour produces. Research has shown that humour can actually improve your physical immune system. Another physical health effect of laughter is that it can also improve cardiovascular health and lower heart rates, blood pressure and muscular tension. But wait, because in human beings, aside from improving your health, laughter can be a productivity tool as well. There's a study from Northeastern University in the States. It found that volunteers who watched a comedy were measurably better at solving a word association puzzle that relied on creative thinking as compared to control groups that watched horror films or quantum physics lectures. And it's not just in the mind, it's measurable physiologically. We know now that laughter lights up the anterior cingulate cortex, an area of the brain associated with attention and decision-making, and make that area of your brain buzz with activity and energy. So yes, human beings really do benefit from having a sense of humour, but why on earth would you think God would need one? Does he need his anterior cingulate cortex lit up to be able to pay attention and make decisions better? Well, of course he doesn't. But he knows you. And he knows that you need humour to function well psychologically, physically and cognitively. And he knows that because he made you. So does God have a sense of humour? Yes, of course he does. Not because he needs one, far from it, but because you do. And that accounts for why we have an example of incongruity theory humour right here in Esther chapter 6. You see, it's the way things get totally reversed that makes Esther 6 so beautifully stimulate your anterior cingulate cortex. Here's how it pans out. Firstly, in verses 1 to 3 of Esther 6, a debt of gratitude gets surprisingly rediscovered. Esther 6, 1 to 3. That night, the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honour and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. Now you might think it's hard to see how a sleepless night could be a good thing, but the whole reversal of the dreadful situation the Old Testament people of God were in stems from a brutal despot having a bad night's sleep. Here's where the tables start to turn. The Hebrew text here says the sleep of the king fled, but in place of the rather innocuous comment there in the Hebrew text, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, says, and the Lord removed the sleep from the king. The Lord removed the sleep from the king. So the Greek text understands the statement in a more overtly theological way. It puts it in a different, saying the same thing, but it puts it in a different way than the Hebrew text. Although even in the Hebrew text, there may be a hint of God's providence at work in this matter, and that gets accentuated when it's translated into the Greek, you see. After all, this event is crucial to the later reversal of Haman's plot to destroy the Jewish people. And any sympathetic reader is likely to look beyond the apparent coincidence and say, hello, that's funny, what's going on? The mighty Haman the Agagite, therefore a very much a hereditary enemy of God's Old Testament people, he's cut down from his ever so lofty position by the direct outcome of this apparent chance event when the king just happens to have a dodgy night's sleep and goes for a boring book to put him back. We don't know why he was having a dodgy night's sleep. It could be that he can't sleep wondering about what happened at the intriguing events of the banquet Esther has just held for only him and Haman, where she set up the situation for a proper high-level talk about something, then asked simply for another banquet tomorrow. But in any event, Xerxes can't sleep, so he decides to review court business. Seems a bit like reading old committee meeting minutes in its level of intellectual stimulation. But far from putting him off to sleep, what Xerxes hears, dread to him, stirs the man up quite a lot. In such politically volatile times, you see, especially after his string of defeats and the debts he's incurred but with his armies in the Hellenic Wars, Xerxes has got to be very careful about his own safety and making sure he honours those who keep him safe when plots are in the offing. That was something very important for him to take care of. So Xerxes is mortified then to find nothing has been done to honour Mordecai publicly. In a court full of intrigue, Xerxes won't feel safe with a man like Mordecai hanging around, nursing a grudge, because he's foiled a plot against the king's life and not been rewarded. Worse, Mordecai's service happened 5 years previously. So Xerxes is going to reckon that's been playing on Mordecai's mind for quite some time, and something big is going to need to be done for Mordecai, and rapidly, to put this right. Well, in verses 4 to 9 then, pride comes before a fall. The king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about impaling Mordecai on the pole that he'd set up for him. His attendants answered, "Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in," the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honour?" Now, Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honour than me?" So he answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honour, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn, and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honour and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honour.'" Where have we got to? Let's summarise. Well, the king couldn't sleep. He discovered that Mordecai, who'd saved his life, had been overlooked for the last 5 years, and in a flat funk about the perceived risk of leaving this Jewish guy Mordecai unrewarded for so long, he just reaches out for the first person, doesn't he? The king just reaches out for the first person who can be called upon to resolve the problem immediately and, in inverted commas, by some strange coincidence. It's a phrase that's going to crop up increasingly frequently as God's providence is worked out across the face of this book now. By some strange coincidence, Haman has just strolled into the court. Haman has come in to get Xerxes to order Mordecai to be impaled on the 75-foot-high pole that Haman has set up for him. But Haman can't broach the subject with Xerxes before the king says to Haman, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honour?" That's Esther 6, verse 6. And we're told immediately in the same verse, Haman reasons, "Who is there the king would rather honour than me?" Here's where Haman really sets himself up to meet his very own personal Waterloo. It is so ironic. And we're in on it because we, the audience in this West End farce type scenario, know exactly what's going on here. But crucially, the baddie Haman does not know. So Haman, who is second only to the king, can't dare ask for more honour than being second in command, because that would be treason, gets as close to asking for royal honour as he can. And he asks to be paraded with a royal robe the king has worn, and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honour, lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what's done for the man the king delights to honour. As we look on, Haman thinks that'd be amazing. And so does Xerxes think that'd be amazing. But they both have something very different in mind. That's what we, the audience, know, and we can see this is deeply ironic. It's farcical. The most enormous reversal is about to happen, and we, the onlookers, are the only ones that are actually in on it. It's precisely what is funny about 20th century farce. And it's all the funnier because this section where Haman rubs in the honouring bit, at 5 verses long, this section, is easily the longest section in this chapter. Which ensures the hilarious humiliation gets well rubbed in. So that's the next thing in verses 10 to 11. A hilarious humiliation gets well rubbed in. Haman's advice about honouring the one that the king desired to honour was to send for a robe and a horse. That's verses 8 to 9. And although Haman thinks this plan is going to exalt him, we can see this disaster working out before our very eyes because it's going to turn out to be the exact bubble-pricking opposite. See, even when directing human history to preserve his people against genocide and extermination, God acts in such a way as to heal human hearts, minds, and leadership qualities with a huge display of deep, ironic humour. Esther 6:10-11. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Go at once. You go at once. You go, get the robe and the horse, and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended. So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honour. And that was a huge big slap in the face for the haughty Haman. And it's a reversal that's going to be bringing with it enormous consequences. So in verses 12 to 14 of this chapter of Esther 6, a reversal in destiny gets declared. Afterwards, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisers and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. And while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet that Esther had prepared. There has been a huge turnaround here for Haman. Now we spoke about the reversals in Esther way back before Christmas as we set out on our series of sermons in this book. And the big theme of this book is the way that God works behind the scenes to reverse the situation that looks hopeless for his people, to not just preserve, but to honour and to exalt them. Yeah, it's funny because the reversals of the proud and haughty do often pan out like that. You can't read Proverbs or the Old Testament prophets without noticing that God opposes the proud but exalts the humble and meek. And this account here in Esther 6 is the first of a set of reversals that are now going to take place to glorify the God who, in his providence, reverses hopeless-looking situations to protect, not just to protect, but to bless his holy people. That's all been simple and straightforward, hasn't it? So let's come to a conclusion here with lessons learned. See, Esther 6:1, it seems like a small thing in the Greek text, and the Lord removed the sleep from the king. Things had been pretty desperate for God's people. They were looking grim. There was a day set, a future date, when everybody was going to turn on the Jewish people, according to this edict that Haman had got Xerxes to order, sent out everywhere for it to happen. Things were looking really grim. but an unseen power controls the destiny of all people. And that power isn't a power, but a person. A person with a pledge to his people, a pledge to protect and to save and to redeem, a commitment to his covenant and his cause. Beneath the surface of human decisions and actions and circumstances, there is an unseen, all-powerful one, not it, but a one, at work, who cannot be explained, outperformed, or thwarted. As Karen Jobes puts it, regardless of how circumstances appear, God is ruling history according to the ancient covenant that he made with Israel at Sinai. Now, that never gets said out loud in this book of Esther. It is ever, only, and always for those with eyes of faith to see it happening. Previously in Israel's history, God used mighty miraculous events to deliver his people and his promises, and we love it when that happens. But here, in the ordinary events of life, a sleepless night and a boring book, God keeps his covenant promises once delivered to his people. See it like this. We love it when God does the miraculous, right? We love for that to happen. But any deity worth the title could do a miracle now and then. That was the consciousness of the people. And we know from the New Testament, even the enemy of souls does lying wonders. 2 Thessalonians 2:9 says that he does those to deceive, if possible, even the elect. Those are the words in that text. I can look up 2 Thessalonians 2. But our God, the God of the Bible, is so powerful that he can, if he wishes, work without wonders through the ordinary events of the lives of billions of people across millennia in time to both fulfill his ancient promises and accomplish his eternal purposes. And no other being can do that, because he is the sovereign God. And that providence is also at work in his very own people's lives. Reversals arising out of the ordinary things in life are very well within his repertoire. So let's give that some thought, because it's not a thought we often come across or come up with, is it? Does God have a sense of humour? Well, we mustn't say that he needs one. He needs nothing of the sort. But in terms of human weakness, humour from him can be helpful and encouraging and uplifting physically, psychologically, and cognitively. And this sort of humour, not a mocking humour, but this sort of reversal type humour where unexpected things happen, it is the humour of the farce. He does deal in to lift and to strengthen and to help us in our weakness. And he seems to be doing that to me in Esther 6. Reversals are very well within his repertoire. Now, what exactly are we praying that he will reverse to help and to deliver you? Are you then consequently totally ready for him to fulfill his own reversed up purpose with your very own life, with surprises we cannot anticipate or imagine? Well, do let us know if we can pray for you. And may God bless you in his providence in the ordinary things, the circumstances and affairs of life. And may you have a very good week.